I'm fine. And you have to say it like that because there's an exclamation mark at the end of it. Thoughts on Life, Addiction, Love and Health. It's a new book by Enda O'Doherty, who's in our Waterford studio. How are you doing, Enda?
I'm in bits, Ray. I swear to God, could you not have had someone on talk about global warming before me? And I'm as bad as you. I grew up, my parents made me watch Little House on the Prairie every Sunday and it turned me into an awful softie.
You're a crier.
Last piece was incredible. What an amazing woman.
I think when you have children of your own, not that anybody who doesn't have children is incapable of crying, but it makes things like that, stories like that hit
inspirational
home.
Inspirational woman. Yeah.
Well, I'm sure that's a word that's been used to describe you, Enda O'Doherty. So where do we start? we won't start at the top of Kilimanjaro with a washing machine on your back. We start in Dunlavin playing badminton.
You really have done your research.
Yeah. Well, I read the book. That's what you do, you see.
I know. Right? Do you know, one of your researchers was talking to me and she asked me five or six different questions and I kept thinking to myself, how does she know all this? Because this is my first book and this is a brand new experience to me. But yeah, back in Dunlavin, my parents moved there in 1972. We moved from Mullingar. And so my sister, all these names would be well known to you. My sister would have gone to the Cross and Passion.
Oh,
and,
yes.
I went to Killeshea and then on to Newbridge College, and there were great days, and then finally on to Maynooth. And I suppose that led me in 1990 down to Waterford. My mother put a suit out on the bed, Ray, and she said, "Do you like that?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "That's the last thing I'm buying you," because I was off for my first job teaching in Waterford, and down I've been since 1990.
Right. No, I was interested with badminton because it was a family of Peard. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's right, yeah.
Because I'd never heard that name before, and that was the reason that Dunlavin. They were the reason that Dunlavin was a hotbed of badminton talent.
That's right, yeah. We had county players and national players and Leinster players.
And who were the Peards?
So Mark Peard, his grandfather, Mr. Peard, we'd always call him Mr. Peard, he was a world champion in badminton and had played in the All England Badminton Championships and ended up living in Ireland and ended up coaching us. And it's one of those bizarre things. We couldn't play hurling, we couldn't play football, but the entire village was obsessed with badminton, yeah.
Right, okay. So you played a bit of rugby, as I like to say, played a bit of rugby for Newbridge, but did you break a vertebrae? Was that what ended your rugby career?
Yeah, so I got a bit of a wallop in the back, and I remember a referee came over to me and said, "Enda, you okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm fine." And he said, "Stand up." And I said, yeah, I will. And I couldn't feel anything, couldn't feel my legs. I got a right wallop out, and it's just a way of your body protecting you. So my body switched off and stopped me feeling any more pain for the minute. So I made an early retirement, probably right. Just as well, Ray, given my obsessive tendencies in life. I probably would have gone too far playing it, as in most things in my life.
Yeah, that's a recurring theme, isn't it? obsessive behaviour and addiction.
Yeah, like I'm an alcoholic, which, you know, in Ireland doesn't make you any way unique. It's 12 years, thank God, now since I've had any alcohol. But, you know, part of my journey in this book is that I learned that, you know, sometimes our darkest secrets, our demons, our most difficult times, just like Jane there, you know, can turn out to be our greatest achievements, if you like, are our greatest strengths. I'm kinder to me now. You know, I am still the same obsessive person. Like I talk too much, I dance too much, I sing too much, I laugh too much, I eat too much, I exercise too much. But the things that I do now too much are things to help me, my family, or me and my career, or you know, people I care about. And it's the same person. You know.
When did you have your first drink?
God, no one has ever asked me that, Ray. I had my first drink, you're going to really laugh now, Nijinsky's. Can you remember Nijinsky's?
I was DJ there for
I probably was those people that shouted at you and you nodded, I'll play that, and went away again.
Play Summer of 69 there. No, yeah. I won't.
Well, it would have been Come On Eileen. Bad. Right. Yeah, so that was my first drink. I suppose, look, it was... For me, you know, sometimes people say, you know, when did you become an alcoholic? I think, you know, going back through my family, definitely, you know, it was in our genes. But I think my natural personality type meant that I would, you know, naturally fall into something that could be addictive, you know, and I didn't see it coming. You know, it's a bit like a fog. It sort of slips in, you know, all of a sudden I was drinking, I suppose, by adulthood at my worst or best, however you want to phrase it. I was drinking about 4 bottles of whiskey a week. My Friday night drink would have been a pint glass of vodka. And after a while, I used to drink Benlin with that because... incredible. Oi. Well, a pint glass of vodka was like you having 2 glasses of wine. I was relaxed, you know, I wasn't particularly drunk, and it was going to kill me, you know.
You from reading the book, you were high functioning in that you were holding down a job as a secondary school teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like a lot of people with substance abuse or addiction, I was suited, booted, first in, last out, smile on my face. I was, you know, wasn't running around the streets breaking things or letting people down. But I describe what was happening in my life to people as slow motion suicide. You know, I had that pint glass of orange, say, at a social function, but it was really full of gin. You know, if there was a staff outing, I would be there an hour before everyone else to make sure I had my three or four drinks, strong ones, on my own, you know.
Yeah. And you discovered loads of empty wine bottles in a shed recently, did you?
Yeah, yeah. So the book was finished and the publishers were all delighted and, you know, it's a huge amount of work. And then I rang the good Jerry Kelly and Red Stripe Print and I said, Jerry, we need to put another chapter in. He said, no, we can't do that, you know. And I said, well, look, we were like a lot of people during lockdown. Our garden was turned into a snooker table. It was that manicured by the end of it. But yeah, we moved the shed, or we were cleaning out around the garden shed, and I found a whole pile of bottles where what I was doing was, you know, like a lot of couples, you know, we had our wine in the garden shed that we brought back from France. But when my wife would send me out to the shed, Ray, and she said, go and get a bottle of Chianti, I went out and I would nearly always drink the entire bottle in 30 seconds and then bring in the real bottle of
Chianti. So you'd neck it?
In like a shot. Yeah, like a shot. And then I suppose the deception then is that I would probably say, I'll have one large glass. And she'd say, will you have another glass? And I said, you know, I'm okay tonight. But I was already after having the entire bottle, you know. Yeah. But when we moved the shed, I found them. And to be honest, it's a different Enda. You know, I know in the book I write a bit about Enda 2.0. You know, I sort of looked at the shed and these bottles and I thought, what the hell? Like, how did I go from sitting in the shed doing that to working as a motivational speaker, yeah, an author? You know,
we'll come to how you give up the drink in a moment, but I'm just, I'm sort of, you know, our relationship as a nation with alcohol is dysfunctional. And do you see that more clearly now that you're a non-drinking alcoholic?
Yeah, I'm a great fella to have at a party because I'm still as loud, I'll sing as much, and I'm as much crack. And I'm a great man to pour a drink because just because I can't drink doesn't mean nobody else can, you know. But I would definitely see that, you know, like, you know, the baby's born, we wet the baby's head. The baby's 18, we buy them the first legal pint. The baby's 21, we'll celebrate. We win the county final, we'll fill the cup. We lose the county final, feck it, we'll go and have a few drinks. You know, somebody, you know, the kids have the first communion. We put the tent up, the bottles of Prosecco, confirmation, we'll do it again. And I got caught up in that. That, you know, that wasn't just the only time I drank. Any excuse, everything was connected to alcohol, you know.
Yeah. And do you think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but like in America now, they're re-looking at the whole labelling of somebody being an alcoholic because they reckon that it lets people off the hook. It's like you're either an alcoholic or you're not. Whereas a large majority of people have a problem with drink.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's for me, addiction is about honesty. Like, I lied to everyone around me and I particularly lied most of all to myself. You know, I didn't realise, you know, the damage that I would have done to my health long term if I'd kept going with that volume of alcohol. The waste of life, you know. I often tell people, you know, the average person listened to your radio show today, and I don't want to depress anyone, but the average person is going to live 28,000 days.
Right.
And it's really important that you fill those days, you know, whether it's helping a children's hospice, whether it's being kind to people, whether it's doing the best you can at your work, whatever you are, having the best relationships with your family or friends, being as healthy as you can. We need to squeeze the life out of every one of those days. And I think the sad thing about addiction is that you lose that potential.
You lose an awful lot of days, don't you?
You do, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And it's about, you know, I think right now, you know, it was interesting when you talk about the shed there and we wrote the chapter on COVID. I think a lot of people for the first time in their life might be experiencing anxiety and stress and not realising what it is. And the first few days of COVID, I certainly felt, you know, return to the dark, bad days. But very quickly, I realised what was happening to my mental health. And very quickly, I was able to take actions and do things to put myself back on track, you know.
So you gave up the alcohol in a cold turkey fashion.
Yeah, like a lot of things, Ray. I didn't do it the logical, safe way. So I played a tennis match one night in Waterford's fantastic tennis club, St. Anne's, and came home wired with adrenaline after playing a match late under lights, and poured myself a brandy and milk, which was my favourite drink. I read one stage Brendan Behan loved brandy and milk, and I said, if it was good enough for him, it's good enough for me. And I woke up the next morning and I simply said to my wife, you know, between the adrenaline from the sport and the brandy, you know, that bad night's sleep where you're asleep but you're not rested, and I said to my wife the next morning, I said, that's it, I'm done.
But was there not a sort of a road to Damascus epiphany? Was there not you at your lowest moment?
No, do you know, I think sometimes people often talk about hitting rock bottom. You know, as funny as it is, my moment of my Damascus moment, as you put it, was I said to my wife, I'm giving up. I'm going to stop. I'm going to change my life. And she said, that's great, love. And any married man listening to this knows there's a particular tone of voice that girlfriends and wives use. And if you saw the script, it said, that's great, love. But the reality was she didn't believe it. And I suppose it mirrors what the book is about in terms of resilience and overcoming difficulties, because, you know, the mental and physical challenges that I went through in sobriety to inspire people and to help people all evolved around the fact that someone said, Enda, do you know what? You can't do that. There's no way you can walk from Belfast to Waterford with a washing machine on your back.
And you definitely won't climb Kilimanjaro.
You definitely won't.
They were sort of half right there. No,
sure. Three quarters. Right.
Right. But I suppose that let's then tease out where the relationship with Pieta House came, because after you gave up the drink, that's when I suppose you'd been self-medicating.
Yeah, like a lot of people, you know, a lot of people, I was unaware that I had anxiety disorder, I had depression, I had sleep disorder, I had panic attacks, and I was medicating, you know, with alcohol. When I stopped, I did cold turkey, and I suppose initially I survived is the only way to describe it, because for 4 or 5 months I didn't sleep. I mean, you know, I often tell people, I can remember sitting in our bathroom watching sunrise and being delighted that the sun came up, because that's when the demons would end. That's when I could put on the clothes and go into work and pretend to be normal. And I suppose I promised myself that I would get as strong and as healthy and as fit and appreciate what I had in life. And I also promised myself, and I would have said it to my family, that I knew what hell looked like. I knew what dark clouds felt like to be walking around in them. And I promised myself that if I got free, that I would save or help someone else come from, you know, that darkness. That was what I wanted to do.
Yeah. And you read the statistics that 10 people take their lives to suicide every week in Ireland. And you saw Pieta House and Joan Freeman and how inspirational she was, and you decided to help them. And how did the washing machine thing happen? Did you look around at all the white goods and you decided which is the heaviest or which is the most awkward, or what was it?
Well, it's something like that. You know, the thing is, you know, you were talking there a few moments ago about fundraising. It's very hard to raise funds in Ireland, and you do need a hook. You need something that people will pay attention to, or, you know, that media in particular will grab hold of. So the media hook was the washing machine, and it definitely works. So look, I've been on your TV show, and here we are talking now, and there's a book. But I suppose the story with the book came about, but the washing machine came about because, you know, I said to my wife, you know, I'm going to walk from
Maeve,
Belfast.
We give Maeve her a name.
Lovely Maeve.
And you write so lovingly about Maeve in the book. It's a beautiful thing, and you've set the bar very high for the rest of us, I can tell you.
No, not at all. I tell you, Ray, she's everything that I would love to be. She is the, she's the most gentle, caring, quiet person. You know somebody who, you know, if she has something bad to say or negative to say, she doesn't. And if she doesn't raise her voice. She's calm. She's just lovely.
You proposed to her within what, a week of meeting her?
Yeah, I met her in Maynooth on a Monday, and she was in first year in college, and I met her and I asked her to marry me over a creamy bun in the Elite Cafe in Maynooth on the Wednesday, 2 days later. And her exact words were, go home to your mammy and grow up, because I was only 19 and I didn't have the bus fare, never mind anything else. But I said to her I was going to carry a washing machine from Belfast to Waterford. She said,
this is years after you proposed for now.
This is years afterwards. Before the charity escapades. And she said, initially I said, I'm going to walk from Belfast to Waterford and raise funds and get people talking about mental health and get men particularly to talk about suicide and to talk about, you know, depression. And my wife's exact answer was, is that all? And I said, well, in that case, I'll carry a washing machine. And she said, go on. And I said, I will. And 9 months later, I walked out of the Europa Hotel with a washing machine strapped to my back to do 9 marathons in 8 days to walk from Belfast to Waterford with my washing machine.
And you did it. It was painful, and you fainted and you puked and you did all sorts of things.
Yeah, but sure, look, listen, about day two, the main road turned into a snake because I was hallucinating. I hope nobody's sitting down to their dinner now or their afternoon tea, but I lost all of my toys. toenails, my fat pads, my feet. I broke both feet. I had what only can be described as combustible diarrhea. But I got through. I kept going because, you know, the message with the washing machine, Ryan, the message throughout the
share
book
the
was
load.
Share the load, ask for help. You know, I was clearly carrying something. You know, I picked up a washing machine because it was the most stupid load I could carry around. You know, if as you look around the studio there, look into the production area there in front of you, like, somebody will smile and be getting on with their job and you can't see the load they're carrying. And some people are carrying such a significant load. As you say, like 10 of those people will lose their lives to suicide this week. And the first thing you know is when you hear, God, did you hear the terrible story or the terrible news about somebody? Mm. And you're shocked because you didn't know they were carrying that load. So my simple message with the book was, you know, don't carry something stupid around. If you're in crisis, if you're in trouble, you know, real masculinity, real strength, you know, is ask for help, put that load down and ask for someone, you know, ask someone to, I suppose the second part is to ask people if they're carrying a load, because we can't always see it, you know, it's the perfect, someone described to me yesterday, it's the perfect book cover for radio, because the title is I'm Fine and you can visualize it, as you said, I'm screaming in the
picture.
You're
screaming, yeah.
And, you know, what I really wanted people to think about was, you know, at the times when I was at my worst, I told everyone, yeah, I'm good, how are you? I'm fine. And how's the kids? And, you know, I totally buried that I was in real, real trouble, and I wanted to write about it, you know.
Now, we've a lot more to talk about, but we've very little time. So I'll skip on to Up Kilimanjaro with the self-same washing machine, and your sort of best bit, your moment, is something that Maeve said to you.
Yeah, God, we were talking about it this morning, actually. We went for a walk and she said, what do you tell Ray? And I said, I don't know, it's a very small amount of time to cover 6 years, but... yeah, we were on the mountain. I suppose, you know, one thing that struck us was the Africans who we were with had financially nothing, but yet they were completely happy, completely content with their life. You know, one of the porters said to me one day, I showed him my hand and I said, God, I said, what's that under my fingernails? You know, something horrible. And he had a look at my hand, Ray, and he said, you know what that is, Enda? He said, that's adventure. That's life. And it was that kind of wisdom. But, you know, the first time I got off the bus with a washing machine on my back in Kilimanjaro, the Africans had heard about the Irish and how much crack we were and that we were a bit nutty and good crack, you know, and their faces literally, like, where is this fella going to climb the tallest freestanding mountain in the world with a washing machine strapped to his back? And they were shocked. But, you know, by 2 days in, I was walking along one day at my washing machine and, you know, I walked past two Tanzanians and, they raised their fists in the air and they said, share the load. And I thought, this is magic. But on the final day, you know, like, it's a long story and it's a moving story.
It's all in the book. It's all in the book,
as the fella says. But we were in the village, we were in the final camp and the Tanzanians, they wrote a song called Madu Machine Anakoma Simba, which is washing machine man strong like a lion in Swahili. And they were singing this, dancing with tricolours, which we'd given them. The dust is rising. There's literally elephants in the distance. I'm there at my washing machine and so my wife just turned to me and she said, you know, if our kids have 1% of your spirit, I'll be happy. And
that was it. That was it.
Yeah, that's you know, women are fantastic. They can really do so much for us. But I literally didn't speak for a whole day after it. I was just so shocked. But I mean, I was just so privileged. It was just the most amazing, amazing adventure to be part of. And I hope people enjoy reading it, you know.
Yeah, I think they will. I think they will. There's lots in there. Life, addiction, love and health and the washing machine.
Could I just say, Ray, you know, the traditional thing is people say, who's the book dedicated? And sure, I mentioned my family, but this book is dedicated on the front page. I dedicated the book to anyone who's lost family or friends to suicide. I've also dedicated the book to anyone who wanders into a bookshop or anyone listening to this right now and thinks they've no way out. The dark clouds are too dark and, you know, they can't see that sunshine. And I want people to read this book. I want you to be uplifted. I want you to laugh. I want you to cry. But I want people to know, you know, that there's always, always that sunshine.
Enda O'Doherty, thanks so much. I'm Fine is the book and it's available in bookshops now and online, I'd imagine, as well. Thanks, Enda.
Thank you so much, Ray. Thanks for having me on.
Bye now. Bye.
The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1.